Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone phone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Dr. Messner, please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Krista, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's program. And today's program is a collaboration or partnership between the CLL Society and Cancer Care. And the title of today's program, which is part four of a four-part series, is Managing Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia, CLL and its Complications. And today's program is supported by AbbVie, a contribution from Lilly, and an educational grant from Johnson & Johnson Healthcare Systems, Inc. I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I'd like to just tell you a little bit about who's on the call today. So we have over 254 participants on the call today, and you come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. However, we also have a number of global participants from Belgium, British Columbia, Canada, Germany, Israel, South Africa, and the United Kingdom. So this is a global call, and it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Maziar Shadman. Dr. Shadman is Associate Professor and Innovators Network Endowed Chair, Assistant Medical Director, Cellular Immunotherapy, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center and University of Washington, Seattle, Washington. And Dr. Shadman will be addressing an overview of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, CLL, with key questions to ask and re-ask your healthcare team about adherence, the critical role of caregivers in adherence, and the importance of adherence taking your treatment on schedule. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Shadman.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. So it's my pleasure to be here, joined by my colleagues, Dr. Katai and Dr. Mulvey. So what we thought we would do today was to very briefly go through the major treatment options for CLL and kind of walk you through the challenges that could happen in terms of having side effects, and also focus on the importance of adhering to the treatment and making sure that we get the best and most benefit from the drugs that we are assigned to. So just before I start, CLL and SLL are basically two different presentations of the same disease. So when I use the term CLL and when we use the term CLL today, we are referring to both conditions. For those of you who have the SLL diagnosis, everything applies to SLL as well. So briefly, CLL is a condition that most of the time is diagnosed in patients who are asymptomatic, and many patients may not require treatment early on, and we look for reasons for treatment, including having low blood counts in form of anemia, having low platelet count, low neutrophil count. They may have frequent infections, or they may have large lymph nodes, a spleen or liver, or general symptoms related to CLL. And if those happen, then we start talking about treatment options. There are a few major categories of medications that we offer, and my focus will be on a very important, probably the most important class for CLL, and that's the BTK, or Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitor class. So BTK is a critical enzyme in basically CLL cells to survive, and we have now a number of medications that we can use to target that enzyme in the CLL cells. So the drugs that are approved for CLL in this category are four. The first three, we call them, they're considered covalent inhibitors of BTK. So ibrutinib, the first in class, followed by acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, the two second-generation covalent BTK inhibitors. And then we have pirtobrutinib, which is the only non-covalent BTK inhibitor that's approved for CLL. So the focus today is not to discuss the differences between covalent and non-covalent BTK inhibitors in terms of adherence and, you know, the side effects that we expect from the class in general. We could lump them together and talk about the class in general. So these are, as a quick reminder, these are oral medications. These are medications that are taken PO or by mouth, and the treatment is a continuous therapy until the drug doesn't work or if patients have intolerance and they have to come off. So these are not fixed duration therapy. And that's the first discussion we have with the patients, and kind of relevant to our topic today. It's important to understand the goal of therapy, and for those of us who may not be interested in indefinite therapy, this class may not be the right option. So we want to make sure that patients understand that and patients are okay with taking a medication indefinitely. Of course, if there are reasons to stop the medication, that's a decision that will be made after discussing with the physician, but these drugs are designed to be given indefinitely. Now, ibrutinib, the first-in-class drug, was a revolutionary drug for CLL. It changed the landscape. It basically helped us move away from chemoimmunotherapy to use novel agents, and ibrutinib being a great drug, it also comes with a side effect profile that makes it sometimes challenging to continue. Now, I understand that we have audience from different countries, and you know, access to all BTK inhibitors may not be available. So in patients who have access to ibrutinib, I just wanted to mention that it's a great drug. And we're recently learning more and more that in patients who experience side effects from ibrutinib, dose reduction is extremely important. So we're learning that if patients utilize dose reduction early on, and they can stay on medication and derive clinical benefit from ibrutinib. Of course, if there is access to the next generation BTK inhibitors like acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, our preference these days is to utilize those drugs. Now, let's briefly talk about a few principles here. It's important to understand that these drugs come with a list of expected side effects. Now, the incidence or the likelihood of those side effects happening is different between the drugs, which is not the point of this conversation today. But in general, we should remember that if you're taking a drug like ibrutinib, zanubrutinib, acalabrutinib, or pirtobrutinib, and we have a surgery planned, we need to know that these medications need to be held before and after that procedure, and you know, between 3 to 7 days, depending on the type of procedure. So something to definitely discuss with the physicians. There are, going through the side effect profile, if there is any experience of bleeding. And, you know, bleeding could be defined in different ways. Some patients may experience having red dots or petechia on their skin, or may, when they brush their teeth, they may note like minor bleedings. Most patients tolerate that, and it's not something that they would consider significant. But if there is anything, and you know, we would usually, I talk to the patients, and the message for my patients is that if you believe that the bleeding is something that you're worried about, then you should hold the medication and talk to your physician. Other side effects that we can list here, and probably more common and less clinically significant, are issues with joint pain and muscle pain. I think the key message that I want to give is that communication with your physician is extremely important. In most cases, just adjusting the dose will help the patient to remain on these important drugs. And the good news is that even a lower dose for most of these medications is still effective. So don't feel that if you have to use a lower dose of any of these medications, you're necessarily being untreated or undertreated. You know, maybe that's the right dose for you. What we don't want to happen is to see a patient, and let's say I see a patient every 3 months, and when I see a patient in clinic and I ask them about you know, how things are going and if medication, if they're taking the medication and they tell me, oh, we stopped it 2 months ago because we had joint pain, so we thought we would wait until our next visit to discuss. We would like to know immediately. We don't necessarily have to even bring the patient to make some minor adjustments. If I get a call from my patient reporting a side effect that I believe is related to the medication, I can I can sometimes help them adjust the dose, and we kind of address it in more detail in the next clinic visit. So I think one of the take-home points, hopefully, from this part is to immediately report the side effects. Whenever you're in doubt, for example, you may not remember if you take the medication in the morning and you know, you're questioning whether or not you should take it again, always err on the side of not taking it or skipping one dose. It's not a big deal if you miss one dose of the drug. It's probably more, it's definitely more risky to take an additional dose if you're not sure. Or if you have a side effect and you're traveling and you don't know if you should continue taking it, taking the next dose, skipping one dose until you can talk to your physician is acceptable. And again, it's different than holding it for weeks before you're able to talk to your physician. But in general, BTK inhibitors are type of medications that holding one or two doses until you can discuss with your physician, it's reasonable to do that. One of the absolute important messages that I wanted to give is in terms is having side effects related to heart. So these drugs are known to cause some cardiac adverse events. One of the important cardiac side effects would be atrial fibrillation or irregular heartbeat. And, you know, patients may feel that by feeling like irregular heartbeat or sometimes heart racing. And if that happens, that's something that you need to pay attention to. And, you know, if it's one of those things that you want to present to an emergency department and be assessed for that, because as I mentioned, it's one of the known side effects of this class. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't continue the drug. The good news is that atrial fibrillation can be treated and can be controlled. And many of our patients have concurrent AFib, and they still remain on these important drugs. We just need to know about the AFib soon, and we need to be able to treat it the way we treat AFib, regardless of the CLL history. And again, this is one of the other situations that it's absolutely recommended that when that happens, you hold your medication, you let the atrial fibrillation treat it, and then your hematologist or oncologist will be working with your cardiologist regarding the timing of going back on this treatment. Or maybe after talking to you, you decide that, or they decide that, you know, switching to another class would be the right way of doing it. But holding the drug and seeking immediate attention in terms of having a cardiology assessment is extremely important. And, you know, just to, I think I have 30 more seconds. I mentioned some of the more common side effects like joint pain or muscle pain, sometimes the skin changes. Some of the members of this class, like ibrutinib, may cause rash and nail changes and hair changes. Again, these are type of side effects that we can most of the time address by adjusting the dose. And now with the availability of the new members of this family, sometimes we switch from one of the drugs to the other ones, and that's also something that you need to consider. So for me, maybe the two take-home points is like immediate, and immediate doesn't mean necessarily that if you have to skip a dose at night, you don't need to talk to your physician overnight, but like the next day when possible, discuss with your physician if you're stopping or holding your medication. Number two, remember that there is a slight bleeding risk. So if you have a surgery planned or if you have any procedure, make sure that you're holding the medication. And number three, anything related to heart in terms of having irregular heartbeat or any cardiac symptoms, stop the drug, seek immediate medical attention, and then let your cardiologist and oncologist talk to you about the plan moving forward. Thank you very much. I'll stop here.
Thank you so much, Dr. Shadman. That was really excellent. And as the first speaker, you really set the stage for today's program, and you've given people a lot of information, which I'm sure they'll have questions for during the Q&A. So thank you so much. A really excellent, stellar presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Adam Cote, and Dr. Cote is Associate Professor, Hematology and Medical Oncology, Department of Medicine, ICANN School of Medicine, Mount Sinai Hospital, New York, New York. And Dr. Cote will be addressing discussion of barriers to taking your treatment and pills on schedule, tips to overcome these barriers, planning ahead, lead time, filling prescriptions, weekends, travels, special occasions, and holidays, and practical help from family, partners, caregivers, and others. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kotay.
Hi, everybody. Really happy to be here to talk about these particular topics. In addition to discussing these three things that Carolyn mentioned, I'm also going to talk about the BCL-2 inhibitor venetoclax and the anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody obinutuzumab to help you all with your managing your CLL and its complications. And so the venetoclax plus obinutuzumab is the other option for patients to receive in the treatment-naive setting, and venetoclax plus rituximab is typically given in the second-line setting as compared to the BTK inhibitors. And this has been covered in prior cancer care talks, but, you know, we don't know which of these agents, the BTK inhibitors or the venetoclax plus the obinutuzumab, is the superior frontline agent. Hopefully we'll have newer data based off of the CLL17 study in a few years to help answer that question. But venetoclax plus obinutuzumab is also a pill. So venetoclax is a pill. Obinutuzumab is an infusion. So it kind of comes with its own pluses and minuses in terms of adherence and also toxicity. So first off, as opposed to the BTK inhibitors, venetoclax plus obinutuzumab is typically only given for one full year. But it does require a little bit more upfront monitoring as compared to the BTK inhibitors. And so you kind of have to buy your time when you're first starting the combination, but you do get the benefit of having to stop it after 1 year. And so what do I mean by buying your time? So when we start venetoclax plus obinutuzumab, you have to come in weekly to monitor for infusion reactions for the obinutuzumab and for something called tumor lysis syndrome, which can be caused by both obinutuzumab and venetoclax. And so when you come in for this regimen, you start off by getting the obinutuzumab on day one, then you get it on day two, day eight, day 15, and then you start the venetoclax on day 22, and then you ramp up the venetoclax weekly until you get 400 milligrams. And so when we're doing this, we basically have to see you once per week for the first 2 months to monitor your labs. So the big side effect is that infusion reaction that occurs with obinutuzumab at the first dose. It typically happens in most patients, but we know about it, so we pre-treat you, and the nurses are very well aware of how to manage this infusion reaction when we begin the infusion. Now, the venetoclax, when we start that, we are worried about something called tumor lysis syndrome. Basically, these drugs work really well at killing our CLL cells. And when the CLL cells fall apart, they release all their contents into the bloodstream, which can put a lot of pressure on your kidneys to filter out all these toxins that are produced. And so we just have to make sure that your kidneys are functioning okay and check some other labs around the administration of the venetoclax when we first start it to make sure you're not getting this dreaded side effect. Now, once you're through the first 2 months and you're through this first weekly ramp up, pretty much most patients have some smooth sailing from here for the full year. But there are two main toxicities that we have to watch out for. One is low cell counts, specifically low white blood cell count in your neutrophils, which can put you at risk for infection. And so typically we might have to adjust the dose of the venetoclax for this or hold a dose of the obinutuzumab. We also can give Neupogen or Neulasta, which helps stimulate the white blood cells to be present. So that's a big thing that we have to monitor for patients who are on venetoclax plus obinutuzumab. The other big thing is going to be diarrhea. So venetoclax can cause diarrhea in about 30% of patients, if not more. And so make sure that if you're having diarrhea, to chat with your doc about it. I've had some patients who've had some diarrhea with venetoclax, and usually I can get by, and the patients can get by with just adding loperamide once per day. It's an over-counter Lamotil also works. And so really talk to your doctor if you're having recurrent diarrhea from your venetoclax, since that can be complicated. Similar to the BTK inhibitors, if you are having a side effect from your venetoclax that you think is due to the venetoclax, it's okay to hold the pill. But make sure you talk to your doctor about it. So if it happens overnight, feel free to hold the morning dose. Nothing bad is going to happen if you hold your venetoclax for a day or two before you talk to your doctor. But so I just want to highlight that. It's okay to hold it for a day or two if necessary. So if you're having bad diarrhea, the loperamide is not working, just hold your venetoclax and talk with your doctor the next day, and it should be fine. Now, In terms of overcoming barriers to making sure you take your pills on schedule, what I usually tell my patients is to make sure to set an alarm, a pill alarm. Every day your pill alarm goes off at 8 a.m. or 7 a.m. whenever you wake up, take your pill, and it's a really easy way to remember to take your pills and not forget to take them. And this is a big change in terms of, focusing on adherence for our patients, because previously we had used infusional chemotherapy. Now we need to make sure that our patients are taking their pills like they should, once a day or twice a day in terms of certain medications. Another thing that you can do is make sure just to pack your pill along with your other pills and take them all at the same time. One thing that you do want to do, and I think that Dr. Mulvey will be covering this, is chat with your pharmacist about, can you take your pills all at the same time? Should you spread them out based off of some timing? Because there are some interactions that can occur between different pills. Now, in terms of planning ahead, lead time bias in refilling prescriptions, weekends, travel, special holidays, et cetera, these are all specialty drugs and sometimes can require specialty pre-approval. So make sure that if you are going to be running out of your pills, that you let your doctor know a week or two ahead of time, because sometimes it can take a while to get that refill, especially because these are specialty drugs. And some insurances are a little bit more time-consuming in getting these approvals than others. Last, in terms of getting practical help from family partners, caregivers, and others, one thing I do recommend to all of my patients is to make sure that they bring a care person with them to every single visit. These visits can get quite complicated, and ultimately, one thing can be said that goes in and out the ears is tough to memorize, is tough to remember, and having someone there with you at your appointments with your doctor can make it much easier to remember everything that's been said. I also encourage my patients to write down their questions ahead of time and come in with the questions. Make sure you write them down, because we all know we might think of something and then forget it the next minute. So make sure you write down your questions and bring a caregiver. So I just want to summarize real quick, and then I'll pass it off to Dr. Mulvey. But with venetoclax plus obinutuzumab, in general, the hardest part is that first 2 months when you're coming weekly, monitoring your labs, monitoring you for that tumor lysis syndrome. And the biggest side effects that we see are neutropenia, which means low white blood cell count, which can be related to infection. So if you do have infections, make sure you're talking to your doctor. If you do have neutropenia, oftentimes we do a dose hold or a dose reduction or treat with Neupogen or Neulasta or all three. So something to definitely pay attention to. And then with diarrhea, usually loperamide really helps our patients. In general, we can also add Lamotil, and it's okay if you need to stop your venetoclax for a day or two, but just make sure you talk to your doctor about stopping it. There's not going to be very much risk to stopping it for a day or two if you think you're having a side effect that could be due to the venetoclax. So on that, I'm going to pass it over to Dr. Mulvey, and looking forward to the questions and answer session.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kate. That was really excellent. And I know they'll wonderful presentation, stellar, and of course, there will, I'm sure, be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Aaron Mulvey, and Dr. Mulvey is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Weill Cornell Medicine. And Dr. Mulvey will be addressing the role of pharmacy and pharmacist in reminding you about prescription refills, suggestions for people living with CLL and their caregivers to cope with taking charge of your treatment schedule and necessary support for the caregivers. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Mulvey.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for having me. I'm going to be speaking a bit about the role of pharmacists. We've been talking now about some of the potential side effects for medications that we use a lot in CLL, and I think that both Dr. Shadman and Dr. Kate did a really great job reviewing some of these most common side effects with you, and hopefully everyone feels encouraged to share any concerns that you're having while you're undergoing monitoring or treatment for CLL with your doctors and your medical team. I think Dr. Kate also had some really helpful practical tips as you're getting started with treatment and going through. Our priorities as doctors treating patients who have CLL is really to use medications not only to improve patients' overall life expectancy and so on, but really to focus on optimizing people's quality of life. So it's really, really important that if you are experiencing a side effect with your treatment, that you're communicating this with your team so that they can optimize. There's often a lot that we can do to help. These drugs are very, very effective, and they really do work great for a lot of patients. So we want to make sure that we're optimizing things so that patients can receive effective treatments to control and treat their CLL. But in addition to your doctor, nurse practitioner, physician assistant, whoever else your doctor's working with, pharmacists can also be a really excellent additional resource and layer of support. Pharmacists have a lot of knowledge and expertise that's really very helpful. And so I would encourage anyone who has access to working with a clinical pharmacist to really take advantage. Pharmacists can be involved in a lot of different ways for patients being treated for CLL, and this varies a lot based on where exactly you're being treated. For example, patients with CLL who are admitted in the hospital, pharmacists are often involved in not only looking at drug interactions, but also helping to monitor for side effects of medications, looking for additional agents that can help manage some of those side effects. For example, things to control anything like nausea or diarrhea, et cetera. On the outpatient side, though, where most CLL care tends to take place, I think that this is really where pharmacists can play an even bigger role. Because a lot of the drugs that we're using nowadays in CLL are oral pills, these are typically prepared and dispensed by specialty pharmacies, and these pharmacies often have special pharmacists who work with them that are involved throughout all of the different steps involved in treating a patient with CLL. So the pharmacists working at these specialty pharmacies will often be involved in the very earliest steps of reviewing prescriptions, assisting in some of those initial stages of getting insurance approval for the agents, sometimes helping with something called prior authorizations if they're required, which often involves insurance, reviewing details about a person's diagnosis, if there are other treatments they've received, so on. And then the pharmacist will also then, very importantly, double check for any potential interactions with other medications that patients are taking. So this often happens behind the scenes, but many of these special pharmacies will have pharmacists available to make phone calls to patients before they're receiving their medication to really go through the active medication list in detail, which is, again, another added layer of support that likely you've already done with your doctor or your nurse practitioner, physician assistant, so on, but again, an additional layer. Some common medications that have the potential for interactions, for example, include things like warfarin, certain antifungal medications, certain antiviral medications. There are a few cardiac medications that come up. On occasion, people are taking, you know, really strong doses of supplements or herbs. And so, yes, your doctor will be reviewing these things with you as well, but having that additional layer of review is very helpful and in some instances can provide information that maybe, you know, was overlooked or wasn't clearly communicated. So it's really important to know about these interactions because it sometimes can require dosage adjustment of the CLL medications. Other times it will make us monitor more closely for side effects. Rarely would it lead to medications not being able to be used safely, but it, you know, can lead to a bigger discussion of alternative combinations or other adjustments. The other area that pharmacists can be very helpful too is in addressing any barriers that might be coming up to patients taking their medications. So as you start on these oral medications, right, they need to be refilled continuously, typically on a monthly basis. And so the pharmacists keep a really close eye on these things, and they know when that 30-day prescription is running out. So they'll be calling you saying, okay, it's time to be due for your refill. And if a patient says, oh, I'm not out of pills yet, I still have a bunch left, that's a flag to say, okay, what's going on? Why are there extra pills around? And so trying to start addressing those barriers, this is often a really helpful role for them. So whether it's due to side effects that have come up from medications, sometimes patients not being clear on the dosage or frequency, how many pills they're supposed to be taking in the morning, how many pills they're supposed to be taking at night, potentially if there's a barrier with copayments. Not every single specialty pharmacy will provide that service, but some are very knowledgeable potentially about rebate programs or grants that are available with patients to help cut down on some of costs. So that's also a really huge help for a lot of patients. A specific area that I'll mention that I, in my experience, have found clinical pharmacists to be very helpful with is the drug venetoclax. So Dr. Kate had discussed a bit about the oral agent venetoclax. This agent has a very specific schedule of dose escalation, and it can often be quite confusing to keep track of, but many of these specialty pharmacies, as they're providing the initial startup doses, they'll review, again, something that already should be done with your doctor and with your medical team, but another person to go over and review the schedule. So pharmacists really can play a very big role in helping patients with CLL receive treatment safely, to stay on track with treatment doses and schedules, to avoid any potential safety concerns and drug interactions, and sometimes even help guide patients towards cost-saving measures. Okay.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mulvey. That was really terrific and wonderful presentation and lots of wonderful information for our participants. And our next speaker, so just a stellar presentation, thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Brian Kaufman, and Dr. Kaufman is co-founder, executive VP, and chief medical officer, CLL Society, Inc., and he will be addressing the CLL Society's free programs and services. He'll be giving information about their website and also their Ask the Expert. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kaufman.
Thank you for that thoughtful introduction. For those who don't know us, CLL Society is an inclusive, patient-centric, physician-curated nonprofit that addresses the unmet needs of the CLL-SLL community through patient education, advocacy, support, and research. You never need to be alone at any time during your journey, but that is never truer than when one is dealing with complications, as being discussed today. We offer many free services to help. For example, we offer a no-cost virtual second opinion with a world-class expert when you're facing a difficult decision or dealing with a troubling complication of the CLL or its treatment. Just open CLLsociety.org and click on our expert access program to start the process of getting a consult. On our website, you can find 40-plus support groups that meet monthly through Zoom. Chances are good that you will meet other patients and care partners who have experienced what you are going through. At a minimum, our trained facilitators and other attendees can always offer friendship and practical advice. If you prefer to meet one-on-one, we have trained peers who we can connect you with for free one-on-one virtual sessions. We even offer a free non-denominational chaplaincy service. It has usually been more about supporting your emotional or existential rather than religious challenges when battling CLL. Our website, CLLsociety.org, offers valuable information and content in patient-friendly terms about the most basic explanations of all the new terms you're being exposed to, such as what's a lymphocyte or what does the spleen do, to our practical and sometimes life-saving COVID-19 action plan, to the latest breaking news and research presented at important conferences and published journals. We even have a whole section dedicated to complications. At least once a month, we have educational and supportive webinars, podcasts, Facebook Live events, and more. We are constantly fighting for your rights, the FDA, the CDC, CMS, Congress, insurance companies in the pharmaceutical industry, who are public policy and advocacy team. And because CLL is not a solved problem, we are funding research to, among other things, find ways to rebuild our immune system to reduce the common complications of infections and second cancers. Our motto is, smart patients get smart care. You are already part of that smart patient movement by attending this session. CLL Society is here to augment your learning and support you at every stage of your CLL journey.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Kaufman. It's a wonderful resource. Many of you, of course, are familiar with the CLL Society, Inc., but if you're not, please do take advantage of their website, their Ask the Expert, and all the different resources that Dr. Kaufman has addressed on today's program. It's been a pleasure to partner with the CLL Society, Inc. On this particular program or on this four-part series as well. And I'm just going to say a few words about cancer care services. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free programs and services to people living with cancer, with all types of cancer, including CLL. We have a HOPE line, and the number is 800-813-4673, and a website, www.cancercare.org. Many people call our HOPE line in the United States, and actually the HOPE line is answered by oncology social workers. We have about 40 of them. And usually a person calls with a specific question that they would like to have answered, and so the social worker will then address that question, but then review with them all the services we offer. So what are these services? First of all, we do offer practical, financial, co-payment, and food insecurity assistance to people as well. We also have a resource navigation team that will help you find a resource if we do not have the resource that you need. And they will actually stay with you until they find that resource, either in your own community, in your region, in your state, or nationally. In addition to that, we also have a number of online support groups. And those online support groups cover a range of different types of cancers, as well as services for caregivers, people living with different types of cancer, young adults, older adults, partners, caregivers. So it really covers the full range, and that's all listed on our website as well. And we also offer coping circles, which are support programs for people living with different types of cancer as well. And we offer, of course, about 60 or 70 or 80 of these programs per year, these workshops, and we also do have a number of publications and fact sheets that you can access from our website. So that gives you a quick thumbnail sketch of all of the services that we offer, there are many more, so you'll be able to look at them on our website. So now we do have time for a Q&A. I'm going to ask Krista to explain to all of you how to queue up and ask questions. Again, I want to thank all of you for participating in these questions. It helps us to tailor the programs to best meet your needs. Krista?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So the question for Dr. Shadman. What's the latest research regarding a cure, regarding taking a long-term treatment break after several years of remission while on a BTK inhibitor, and regarding reducing the ibrutinib dosage to 140 milligrams a day after keeping CLL at bay on 280 and 420 milligrams a day for a few years? If you could comment on this, Dr. Shadman, in a general way,
to help
all participants.
Yeah, great question about a cure. Unfortunately, despite all the progress that you've made in the past 10 plus years, we still consider CLL an incurable disease, meaning that we can help patients achieve a remission, and these remissions last a long time, but you know, we still expect relapses at some point in patients' lifetime. Now, that, you know, of course, the word cure is a time dependent terminology, meaning that you have to follow patients for a long time, 15, 20 years, and if you don't see relapses, and you may claim that you're curing a subset of patients. So we're hoping that with combination approaches that we have, combining these important classes, BTK inhibitors with BCL2 inhibitors, drugs like venetoclax and maybe a monoclonal antibody, we are now already seeing that patients can have remissions that can last for a long time, but their follow-up is limited and it's relatively short. So in the next decade, we will find out, I hope, that we are actually curing a subset of patients, but this is something that we need to we need to give time to these like follow-ups and, you know, have information in the upcoming 5-10 years. In the meantime, we also need to use better drugs, the drugs that are safe and drugs that are effective. And, you know, I would finish by saying that a big unmet need for CLL is finding cure. So I would invite everyone to participate in clinical trials that are actively looking for this. So the novel combinations that we're using, the one of the big aims for those studies is to be able to find cure for CLL.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. And our next question for Dr. Kate, any tips for how to deal with weight gain on ibrutinib?
To be honest, I haven't seen much weight gain on ibrutinib. And so I would say that if I saw a patient with weight gain on ibrutinib, one of the things I would definitely think about is making sure that it's not fluid weight gain from cardiac abnormalities. So we know that BTK inhibitors can affect your heart, and so that would be the number one thing I'd be ruling out. So I would just make sure that they weren't gaining weight too fast, that they didn't have swelling in their legs that would be associated with heart problems. But if we thought it was strictly weight gain, secondary to just simply weight gain, I would refer my patient to a nutritionist. I would encourage exercise, but typically we don't see much frank weight gain on BTK inhibitors. I'm not sure if Dr. Shadman has seen that, but I know I haven't really seen much of that in my practice.
Dr. Shadman, do you want to comment?
With Dr. Katai's comments, it's not a known side effect, and I would make sure that there's no cardiac issues.
Thank you. Thanks. Another question for Dr. Shadman. Can venetoclax be taken twice? Do trials for sonrotoclax show that patients can take sonrotoclax after they become resistant to venetoclax?
Okay, so if I understand the question right, the question is, can sonrotoclax, which is a novel BCL2 inhibitor, be used after venetoclax in patients who had progressive disease after venetoclax? So we don't know. Sonrotoclax is still an investigational drug in clinical trials, and the study that is studying this drug did include a cohort of patients who had previously progressed on venetoclax. So we don't have data at the clinical level to answer this question. We may have it in future. There is some signal in the preclinical setting, and again, this is before getting to human studies, that there may be an opportunity of even having response in patients who had previously treatment failure with venetoclax. They may still respond to sonrotoclax. These are preclinical studies, but from the clinical human level data, we don't have any data yet.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and for Dr. Kate, how long will pirtobrutinib usually work? If you can answer that in a general way. For Dr. Kate?
Hello?
Oh, Dr. Kate, so the question is, how long will pirtobrutinib usually work?
Hey, I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, yes.
So pirtobrutinib is the new BTK inhibitor that was just approved for patients who have previously received a prior covalent BTK inhibitor and BCL2 inhibitor in venetoclax, and so it's a non-covalent BTK inhibitor that was specifically designed to work in patients who have progressed on covalent BTK inhibitors. So in the study that led to its approval, it was called the Bruin study. Patients who had gotten pirtobrutinib after progressing on those two other drugs had a progression-free survival, meaning how long did it take them to progress on pirtobrutinib? About 15 months. Whereas if they had received no prior venetoclax, it was about 24 months. And altogether, it was about 20 months. So that's the data shows us currently in the relapse setting. Pirtobrutinib is still being studied in the frontline setting and as well as after just one prior line of therapy. So some of that data is going to be coming out now to better answer that question. But typically in the relapse setting, after covalent BTK inhibitor and venetoclax, it should be around 15 months per the clinical trial, but if it's after just a covalent BTK inhibitor without the NUCLAX, it's about 24 months.
Excellent. Thank you so much. These are really great questions, I have to say. For Dr. Shadman, should a watch and wait patient do a trial?
Should watch and wait patients do a trial? Yes, if they, so let me just give you some background. So we pursue watch and wait strategy because in the past, clinical trials that used chemotherapy did not show any benefit in starting treatment early. But we also just shared with you that we're not using chemotherapy. So the question is, does it make sense to use novel drugs like BTK inhibitors, BCL2 inhibitors, and other new drugs in patients who are considered watch and wait candidates today? So we can't answer that question unless we show that we are benefiting patients, and that has to be done in a clinical trial. So the good news is that in the U.S., there is one study that is run by the National Cancer Trial Network. It's a study that, and there are more than one study. There are small studies in different institutions, but the large intergroup study that is going on in U.S. and Canada, at least, is a study called EVOLVE Trial. It's SWOG-1925 is the name of the study, if you want. Basically, in patients with newly diagnosed CLL, within 18 months of their diagnosis, if they are considered to have high-risk or very high-risk disease, and that's a discussion to have with your physician, or if you have what we call complex karyotype, and that's something that on the chromosome study of CLL cells we can find out. So if you're considered to have high-risk disease or very high-risk disease, or if you have the complex karyotype, then you would be eligible to participate in this study, which is supported and funded by the National Cancer Institute, and we're trying to see if starting treatment early with venetoclax and obinutuzumab would benefit the patient in terms of living longer. So it's a very important study, well-designed, and it's currently enrolling. So the answer to the question is if you have high-risk disease or very high-risk disease, or if you have complex karyotype and you have access to clinical trial, the answer is absolutely yes. We're learning about this actively, so it would be very important for our patients to participate in this study.
Excellent. Thank you. And a question for Dr. Katay. One complication we've seen both on venetoclax and now on zanubrutinib is outsized reactions to mosquito and other insect bites. We work on prevention, long sleeves, mosquito netting, hood worn when gardening, but when a bite happens, what do you advise for reducing inflammation, itching?
So this is actually not a side effect to any of our drugs. It's actually common to all patients with CLL. I should say all patients with CLL, but it's a common complaint that I've had from patients. So basically, there's unfortunately not much that you can do besides just using over-the-counter agents. So using your calamine lotion, using aloe vera, anything that might help with numbing the inflammation. I've had some patients who have had severe reactions who we have had to give steroids to, so that it could get that bad that we need to use a systemic anti-inflammatory agent. But it is something that we commonly see in patients with CLL. My general gestalt to it is that it doesn't typically get better with treatment, unfortunately, either. It is understudied on why this happens. We think it has to do with just general immune inflammatory issues that are associated with CLL. And if you are having recurrent inflammatory reactions and bad ones to mosquitoes, I have sent some patients to allergy as well as to dermatology as a second opinion to see if they're missing anything or if there's anything else that'd be given. But typically, unfortunately, it's just the classic over-the-counter medications that we use for mosquito bites. And I have had to use steroids in some patients who've had particularly severe reactions.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And the last question for Dr. Shadman, how long may a patient take a holiday from an oral pill, Abuvica? The statement has been said recently a few times last month. The doctors do not say length of time, though.
So the question is, how long can one stay off ibrutinib? I mean, this is really a question that needs to be answered, knowing a lot of details about the patient and their treatment. What I would say in general is that what we know from the clinical trials is that if you are taking, if you have been taking a drug like ibrutinib specifically for 2 years and you have to stop it because of having side effects, and those patients can actually go for a relatively reasonably long time without needing treatment. I think the average or median time was of being able to be off treatment without having progressive disease was around 27 months or so with the most recent update. So what this tells us, it tells us that if your disease is well treated, in that case for 2 years, and you're stopping it not because of the treatment failure, but because you have the side effects. Some patients, we actually give them a break and see when we have to go back and starting them on treatment. But this is general. So there are patients who should not be off treatment for a long time. And you know, again, it has to do with many variables, including what's the time that they have been on treatment before. If you just started ibrutinib, and it's definitely not recommended that you go off or put it on a hold for a long time. If you have high-risk diseases, and again, a lot of other factors about the history and specifics about the patient, but in general, some patients can be off treatment and do well, but under close monitoring.
Awesome, thank you. And I'm going to ask each of our physicians if Dr. Shadman and Dr. Kate would provide just a takeaway for today's program. So let's start with Dr. Shadman and then Dr. Kate.
Yes, thank you. I think the take-home point is that, you know, we understand that these medications are in general well-tolerated, and some of our patients may feel that this is like an ongoing drug, and they may not feel the need for immediate communication with their treatment team, with their hematologist, if there are side effects. And, you know, just don't wait for the next appointment. If you have to stop the drug or if you're experiencing a side effect that's impacting your quality of life, or if you're noticing that, you know, there are changes that are progressing, and, you know, just number one, it's okay to hold the drug for a day or two and reach out to your physician and ask them about the next step. I mean, sometimes they may need to see you earlier than planned, or sometimes they guide you over the phone. But just keep that communication going. These drugs, it doesn't matter how good a drug is, if you don't take it, it won't work. So we want to make sure that we are giving you the right dose and the right drug.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks, Dr. Shadman. And Dr. Kate.
I completely agree with Dr. Shadman. That was going to be my take-home point. But I'll say something else, too, in that I want to highlight that these drugs typically are very well tolerated. So I would say that before you attribute a side effect to the drug itself, make sure that you talk to your doctor, get a thorough workup, and make sure that you're not missing something else that might cause a symptom that may not be related to your drug. Because at this point, it is important to be able to receive the therapy that we have and not burn through all the options because we assume that a symptom might be due to the drug itself. And so make sure you maintain your communication with your doctor about any symptoms that you might have, because there might be something going on that might be not due to the drug itself. And so I want to encourage just really good communication with your physician is crucial to the success of your treatment for your CLL.
Well, thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I want to thank also all of our participants who really asked such great questions. And we really could go on probably for another hour or so because there are so many questions in queue. So I do want to comment on that as well. For those of you who are able to ask a question, and for those of you who actually have a question yet in queue and didn't get to ask your question, please, all of you, go back to your treating healthcare team. You've learned a lot from today's program. Take that back to your treating healthcare team and ask the questions and re-ask the questions over and over again, or different questions of your healthcare team, because they actually know you the best. They have your healthcare records in front of you, in front of them, and they can really address your questions the very best. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.